everyone, thank you for taking the time and lending your ears to these various conversations. Very excited to share all the guests that I have with you this season, and in order for this season to be a success, I need you guys to help share the word and spread the love of the What Makes You Tick pod. While you're listening, please take a moment to like or subscribe to the podcast wherever you are. And as always, I really appreciate all the help and the support that you guys have given me.
So I think hearing that as a 17-year-old, that was tough. You know, we live in Ireland. We were voted the worst public transport in Europe last week. So not exactly the place to not be allowed drive. And yeah, so there was that, I think, was a really tough time. It was the first time I think that it really meant something, you know, that that condition ever held me back, or, you know, I felt like that was a massive, and I think I just took it really badly.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to What Makes You Tick. And today I would love to welcome my guest, Shane Cassidy, who is founder of a company called Neuralynx. And he is one of the leading music therapists in the country, if not around the world, let's say, right? And let's just say that. Shane, brilliant to have you on board, pal.
Thanks a million for having me. Yeah.
Are you good? Excited. How are you feeling?
I am good. Yeah.
You've done the media circuit in the last while with a lot of work around Parkinson's and stuff. I really appreciate you taking the time to indulge us and to share with the people who listen about the work you do, about what motivates you, and hopefully we get to under your skin a little bit to understand what makes you tick. How was that whole media bandwagon?
Great. Look, it was absolutely incredible. Like, it was, so April was Parkinson's Awareness Month, so did a bit of media coverage around that. And to be fair, like, there's such, I think, an interest here in, like, different approaches to things, and how I think people here, we're getting a bit more holistic in how we approach medicine, how we approach health, how we approach well-being. And
yeah,
like, as a music therapist, I suppose we're in on that, and there's been such a huge interest in it. So yeah, like, nerve-wracking at the same time, you know. Particularly the TV.
You look the business, and in fairness, you came across superb. I suppose let's kind of look at it. Music therapy, as you say, and the holistic approach, right? Neuralynx, music therapy. Like, what is that? What is music therapy?
Okay, wow, big question.
I know, let's go straight in.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, jump right in. So I'm not going to bore you with definitions and all the rest, but basically it's using the element of music to promote or support non-musical outcomes. So when somebody comes to us for music therapy, I suppose the therapy comes first. So what is it that you're coming to us for? What are you looking to get therapeutically from us? And then our job, I suppose, is to go away and decide, well, how can we use music or some of its elements? It might be rhythm, it might be melody, it might be like any aspect of music, using it creatively to support the goal that the person has.
Okay.
So it's quite a different use of music. It's kind of getting away from the idea of music as entertainment or music for enjoyment, which can be a secondary benefit, I suppose, of music therapy, but it's not the goal, really.
So how do people, or who decides that music therapy is the right type of therapy to choose or to even investigate?
Great question. I think no matter what kind of therapy, whether it's a talk therapy, whether it's physiotherapy, whether it's, no matter what the discipline is, I think it always has to be client focused, client led. So I think it has to come from the person themselves to decide, right, this is worth exploring. Our job, I suppose, you know, music therapy, I kind of fell into a trap, I think, myself, of kind of been like, oh, music therapy is quite new. And in fact, it really isn't. It's not new at all. But I suppose it's quite small here in Ireland in particular. So I suppose it's our job to tell people, I suppose, what it can do, some of the benefits, and based on other clients that we've had. And like, I kind of follow very much a neuroscience approach, so neuromusic therapy, and there's really solid evidence. And
talk to me about that. What does that mean, neuromusic energy? Like, that's class, right?
No, neuromusic therapy.
Sorry, excuse me.
It gives you energy.
It gives you energy, right? I'm getting energy from even listening to you talking about it. But what is that? Is that basically watching the pulses of your brain, how it reacts to certain triggers that is basically music? Or like, what is that?
Pretty much, yeah. Like, I mean, so all of it is built on, say, for example, fMRI scans. So all of the techniques in neuromusic therapy are built and were built on neuroscience evidence. So basically putting on ECG, MRI scans, and looking at what exactly is happening in the brain when we're listening to music, when we're playing music, when we're thinking about music, when we're singing. So all of the different aspects of music, and it's incredible to see just the widespread activation of lighting up that happens. They actually don't know of any other stimulus that lights up as many brain regions as music does.
Wow. Because it is like, so for me, I love music, and I'm sure everybody has their various emotional connections to a song, to a melody, to a rhythm, to a beat or something that brings us back to a world where we can kind of, I suppose, it's like smells, or it's like first moments and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Like I remember, like, there's music that you could, we'll look back in the 80s and 90s and go, oh, I remember where I was when that song came out, right? So it's
100%.
Yeah. It's insane, yeah. Right? And my grandmother, my nana, she had onset dementia, right?
Okay.
And eventually Alzheimer's. But what we found was that using music, or playing music from when she was a kid, you could see her nearly just transport back from an 80 odd year old lady to being that 14, 15 year old girl in Kilkenny, you know? Is that something that is that part of the therapy?
That is part of it. It is that link, because there's so much in even just what you said there, like working with, so where I was today, for example, working with older adults, and many of them would have dementia, but certainly cognitive decline would be across the board, just, I suppose, that age group as well. And the research would show, so funny you say about the teenage years, because the research shows that music from our teens and our early 20s, I suppose you could probably say your formative years, that's what appears to get the most response. So teenage years makes sense, I suppose. There's a lot of firsts happening, I guess, and it's quite an emotional time. You know, if you think of your memories, the most standout memories are the memories that were quite emotional, that, you know, there was a high emotion attached to. So they're more easier to recall, I suppose.
Yeah.
And the music then acts as a cue to recall that.
It is fascinating, though, isn't it? It kind of makes sense, because when you're young, years take forever because everything is new.
Yeah.
Right. And as you get older, you hear people say, oh, time's flying.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I'm in that bracket right now, by the way. but it's because there's very little new experiences, isn't it?
Yeah.
It becomes quite natural, like nearly kind of back to cognition. It becomes automatic, doesn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
So just going back to people choosing music therapy, right?
Mm.
So would it be a case that, say, Parkinson's month was in April and music therapy is very effective for people who have Parkinson's, equally so with dementia and the likes, right? But is it typically like a general practitioner or a consultant or somebody like that would lean into suggesting, why don't you go to the likes of Neuralink or Shane to actually try music therapy, because the research has shown that it can help with your existing cognitive issue. Is that who would do it? Or is it somebody coming to you and selecting it and going, I want to try, I think it should be good for me or for my family or for the person who's ill?
It's actually both. And okay. I suppose what's happening now more and more, so Neuralink, I set up Neuralink 3 years ago, start of pandemic. So yeah, great timing.
Solid.
but what's happening more and more now, I suppose the word is spreading. So like that, GPs and physios and OTs and SLTs, speech and language therapists in the community, and psychologists are kind of seeing some of the results of mutual clients. So some of their clients have come to us and they're seeing the benefits and therefore now are recommending it to their other clients. So that's starting to kind of gain momentum. But as well as that, I suppose people looking out for just different approaches and different things, you know, to support wherever they're at, whether that be dementia or brain.
It's kind of like you trial things to see what works for you, isn't it? Yeah. Like, so if you're going to a therapist and you're talking to them, a lot of the time that can be down to the relationship that you'd have with that therapist, and 100%. It may or may not work, right? So then you kind of, it's like nearly on the dating scene, it's nearly like you're actually trying to figure out who's actually the right fit for you.
Absolutely.
And similarly then, if you apply that approach with therapy, you then can say, okay, well, talking psychotherapist or whatever, that doesn't work for me. Musical therapy may work for me. Another type of therapy may not work for me. It's kind of like trial and error.
Exactly. And it goes back to the goal. So say, for example, with the neuromusic therapy, that's very scientific. So say, for example, a lot of our work is with people with stroke and acquired brain injury. And for a lot of them, mobility is kind of one of the main aims. You'd be looking at mobility, speech, language, and then cognition. They'd be the three functional, I suppose, for functional goals or domains that we'd be working through. And with that, I think the science will support that, whether you like music or not, whether you're enjoying the sessions, that it will still have a positive impact on your function. So say, for example, somebody who has aphasia. So Bruce Willis diagnosed with aphasia last year, and there was quite a lot of media coverage around it. So for example, somebody who's had a stroke could have a communication disorder known as aphasia. Now, there are different types. So there's global aphasia, where somebody would have difficulty understanding language and also producing language. But then, like a lot of our clients would have a type of aphasia that their cognition is perfect. Like their receptive skills are absolutely immaculate, but their ability to reproduce speech and to find the word and to recall the word is just a misconnection there. So what we do is we use song, we use music, and we put phrases. So it could be something as simple as, I want to go to the toilet. Something very, particularly if they're still in hospital, they're still going through their rehab journey. But just to be able to communicate for themselves, advocate for themselves, get, you know, if they're hungry, they're thirsty, they're those really basic things.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we attach a song and a melody to that. So that's quite functional. So that's, we know that will work regardless of whether somebody is interested in music or, you know. But I think you're right, first of all, with the relationship. I think no matter what, again, the therapy is, whether it's physio, whether it's speech and language, whether it's psychology, whether it's psychotherapy, I think it's always going to boil down to that relationship with someone and how you gel with someone.
Yeah.
That rapport that you have.
So going back to the way music can help you, say, functionally, when you were talking there, it reminded me of a guest that I had on, a chap called Philly Caldwell. Mm-hmm. And Philly, I don't know if you know this story, but Philly was playing a tag rugby match and he scored a try and he ended up hitting the barrier and he severed his spinal cord or whatever. I think his spinal cord. and Philly lost all feeling, right? And he was given very little chance to kind of walk again, let alone run again, let alone move properly again.
Yeah.
And incredibly, he came back out of it. And within a year, he was walking and attempting to run. And now he's come on so much leaps and bounds. But he said the final part of the puzzle, he said, was his grip, right? In that,
so
we tried connecting with a couple of different people that we knew, but the grip was the piece that was the neurological disconnection, right?
Yeah.
Is that in terms of the functional movement piece, can music therapy help with that style of challenge?
It can. So we do a little bit of work actually now in terms of movement with people with spinal cord injury. And I think it works quite differently because it is quite different than a brain injury, or it can be, because it is really that mechanical mismatch.
I get you. Yeah.
Okay. Whereas with a brain injury, we're really trying to retrain and rebuild the neural pathways and kind of have that is sort of cemented into the neural pathways through repetition. But certainly music will act in the same way, like, say, for example, using rhythm to act as a template for movement.
That's
across the board. We all do it, you know, every single one of us. I find myself always tuning in, like if there's loud music playing and there's a crowd walking, guaranteed almost everybody is walking to the beat. Like, it's just, it's why the way if you go into a supermarket, there's music playing at a certain level. If you go into a department store where they want you to stay for a little bit longer, they want you there for longer. The music is going to be a little bit lower, a little bit slower, so that you're moving around slower. Whereas in a fast food takeaway or in somewhere they don't want you there for long, the music is at high level. It's at a quicker pace, quicker tempo.
Interesting.
They want you in and out. So
I'm going to keep an eye on that now from now on. Dude. And then I'll send you a video. It's like, oh, they want me out.
120 beats per minute marching around.
You'll be like, Steve, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. You should be out.
Was
music always part of your life growing up?
For as long as I can remember.
Tell me what it was like how did music, how has it infected and taken over your life so much?
I think it was just always there. I suppose my mom was a singer. I suppose we came along and probably ruined her singing career, but we would have been singing, I think, before we were speaking, kind of thing, all three of us. So I'm the youngest of three, which I think also helped, because by the time I'm 4 years younger than my brother, who was in the middle, and they were kind of going to piano lessons. They were going to this, that and the other by the time I was crawling,
Yeah.
So I probably ended up starting a little bit earlier because of that, because I was the youngest. And they were like, "Ah, sure, look. Send him off to piano lessons. Give it a go." So I think I was four when I started playing the piano, or started going for piano lessons. And I'm sure there was a bit of pulling teeth at that stage, to be honest, trying to get me to no sit down and pay attention.
How did you kick on from there? Because like sometimes when I'm playing piano, like it's. You have to do these lessons. It's so regimental. It removes the kind of the fun of it.
Yeah.
Whereas, did you stick at it? And how did you progress?
I did. I stuck at it and I got through all of the grades and I did my diploma and that kind of thing. But because I was so young, I think that massively helped. I hadn't reached the teenage year. I had only just reached the teenage years by the time I was doing that. And I was finished the grades and I was finished the kind of, like you say, the monotonous kind of sitting down, going through the motions of exams and that kind of thing. So I think being so young definitely helped with that. If I were a few years older, I don't know, it probably would have been harder to stick with that. And I think from there, I was able to just mess around with it a little bit more and play around with what I had learned. Like you say, it's very much not rote learning, but, how do you play your scales? How do you play three pieces every year and that kind of thing? And
did you find that you were always drawn to music as a result, like afterwards, did you always want to study music then? Did you always want to kind of learn about it? What was it? Was there a kind of like a moment where you went, this is where I want to be?
No, because I think I was so young. Honestly, I was probably about 5 or 6 and people really? Would say, what do you want to do? Music.
Yeah, yeah.
And they'd be like, ha, 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 yeah, good one, you know.
Yeah. Really?
And what do you really want to do?
It was
from a very, very young age that I kind of had decided that. And I kind of just stuck to that, you know, going through secondary school as well. Now, at the same time, never thought it would be music therapy. I didn't even know that music therapy existed. So, but I definitely knew it would be music in some shape or form. And then like through the teenage years, so clarinet was my main instrument. So I kind of started that a little bit later, but again, like kind of went to quite a high level with that and would have focused on that in my music degree then eventually. And for a long time, that was the route I was going down to perform. Brilliant. With the clarinet. But yeah, I just think it had such a massive impact on my life. Like I, as a teenager, going through those awkward teenage years, like, I mean, bedroom door closed, headphones on, full max volume. That was me.
Sorted. F the world.
Yeah. Yeah, literally. I would have been more likely to do that than watch TV. I actually wasn't a massive TV fan as a teenager. I would have happily gone into the room, put my headphones on, listened to music.
And what music, like, was of influence to you when you were young, when you were that age? Like, if you go back to memories and thinking about music as a recalling opportunity there, like, what sticks out or stands out?
Oh, so much. Like, it's so... such an eclectic. I still actually have my collection of CDs at home, like thousands of CDs. And of course, they're in my parents' house still. I wouldn't bring them all, clutter up my own house. But, oh God, like everything. Tracy Chapman sticks out. Absolutely love her songwriting.
Fast Car, isn't it? That was the one that stood out for her, wasn't it? And then the rest
Fast
of them followed.
Yeah, she had an album called Crossroads, I think. And I remember going to see her in what was the Point. I think it was still the Point at the time. And I'm showing my age now.
Say nothing. Trina.
Phenomenal, though. Honestly, you could just hear a pin drop at that. But then loved like kind of more acoustic, like singer-songwriter, folk music. So a real eclectic mix, to be honest. And then I was classically trained as well, and I love classical music as well. Love jazz, love... So, I mean, it just depended on the given day, like what I was in the mood for.
I love jazz as well. We were in New York over the Christmas, and we walked into this jazz bar, and it was incredible. It was literally like we stepped back in time. It was like the tables and chairs were kind of decked out on the ground, and then as the music was playing with a big jazz band in the background, or kind of like on stage, everybody was dressed in the old kind of 1930s 40s gear. And they were dancing away, and like it was their night, and there was their show, and that was it. But jazz is incredible. But if we go back then, just so an eclectic mix of music, eclectic taste. What, as a Mead man in Gibbstown, right?
Yeah, well remembered.
What was it like growing up there?
Ooh, quiet.
give us a kind of a picture of what Gibbstown's about.
It's a beautiful place. It's a really beautiful place, but very rural. At the time, like I'm now living in Dublin 20 years this year, actually. So even though it's a little bit more built up now, but it's still kind of standalone houses. But at the time was very much green fields, farmland, gorgeous little river running by. So very quiet. You know, we would have been 15 minutes to the nearest town, which is Navan. But lovely at the same time. But I think as a teenager there, it's probably too quiet.
Okay. Like what would you be getting up to? Nothing.
Very little. Yeah, you'd have to go to,
you'd be running miles to try get to somewhere to get up to something.
Exactly. Yeah. Until I suppose I was old enough that my parents would go on holiday. And again, going back to being the youngest of three, there were some questionable times when my parents were away.
We probably can't say too much because they're probably going to listen to this and they're not realizing it.
Yeah. Some house parties in Gibbstown. But
and what was the dynamic like for you guys as a family? Like, what was it? Were you all close? Were you all into music? Was like, so you said your mum was and is a singer. Growing up, I always loved the sing song. Always loved when families and stuff would get together. Like, was that a big part of your I suppose relationships?
Definitely. Yeah. And actually, probably more so with age, more so now maybe than when we were growing up.
Okay.
I guess it was more me. Like, the piano was always center stage in the house, really. And then, say around Christmas time, my mum would guilt me into, oh, you have to play it. You know, it's there. So
it's there now.
Go and play it, and put in her requests. But now, like, for example, my dad's 70th was last weekend, and my brother, even though he would have played the piano as well, he in later life taught himself the guitar. So he's an amazing guitarist now. And so we had a massive sing song last weekend, just the whole lot of us getting together, just making music. Yeah. And
it's real old Ireland though, isn't it? Like, exactly. It's a real traditional thing. I think it's something that's probably dying out a little bit now, with certain people or certain demographics or even certain locations, right? But it's what I'm trying to kind of understand as well from you is, like, so music kind of was like nearly the spine of your growth, whether it was at home or whether it was in education. Like, did you have a good music setup when it came to school, when you were in secondary school? Like, was it quite popular, or was that something that you had to fight for?
No, it definitely wasn't popular. And to be honest, it was quite new. And I do remember being a little bit frustrated by it, because I suppose the music curriculum, it's questionable to say the least. And I actually don't think it's changed since. So... being part of that, it was a funny one, to be honest. I did music in school, but I actually, by the end of it, I just did it myself. I didn't do it in school. I decided to opt out of the school part and just do the exam. So I got a bit of like help on the outside, but it was good. Like, I think it was really just starting to take hold. I was in an all boys school. It wasn't hugely popular.
Do you think there's a big job now, say government wise, to actually invest a bit of time into that area? Because I find from our conversation here is that it was in the starting off when you were in school as a kind of like an option to study, right?
Yeah.
Musical therapy is only at its fledgling kind of moments in Ireland right now, and you're kind of leading the way in that. There seems to be like a very much big gap between learning how to use music properly from a school, from a formidable age, to learning how to use it as a therapeutic method.
Yeah.
And there's a big gap there. Like, how do we close that gap?
Definitely. I think there is moves being made, and that's both secondary and primary school, to be honest. Like, just using, again, just having a bit of a tool belt of resources for children, for adolescents, for teenagers to use, and to know that music can be used in a certain way to help them, whether it be struggles with anxiety or struggles with stress or different mental health issues or other issues, or just growing up, you know, just actually using it as a tool.
I think to that point though, you can use music as a way to change your mood, right?
Yeah.
So if you're melancholy, you'll typically listen to those type of songs, which probably don't do anything for you in your health wise, because then you go down this little dark path. Whereas if you can flip it or have the knowledge to know, listen, this isn't good for me right now, and then flip it into positive, kind of uplifting music, it can maybe change your kind of frame of mind a little bit.
And maybe what we would do as well with certain people is what we would call the ISO principle, and we'd start with that melancholy or you know, and gradually move towards where we're okay, this is where you're at right now. You're feeling down, you're feeling sad today, you're not feeling great today. What's the opposite of that? Or what do you want to feel? So you start with selecting music at where you're at right now and gradually move to a place where you want to be. So changing the tone of the music or changing the kind of style of music or the tempo, whatever it is, to try and kind of almost trick your brain into getting there. Do you know what I mean? It's just like that, using it as a tool to help with it.
Because that's what therapy does, right? It gives you the tools to fix things when you're not with somebody. You know, so it's what typically what's the process? Because in order to manage your health and to kind of, even if you want to get fit, you have to go through a process.
Yeah.
It's the same with therapy. Yeah. And what is the typical process? I probably isn't a typical or standard process, but like, your clients, how long would they normally stay with you in therapy?
It really, really varies. And I suppose I'm like a broken record. It does go back to the goal. What is it you're working on? A lot of our clients right now are pretty long term. Like, there's some people I've been working with for 4 years.
Okay.
And it also depends where. So like we obviously have our own clinic, but we also do a lot of outreach work in hospitals and that kind of thing. So say, excuse me, in a rehabilitation context, generally a rehabilitation slot would last 12 weeks. So that might be their window.
Okay.
And in that 12 weeks, you're really looking at honing in and targeting a specific outcome. So for example, gait training after having had a stroke, or working on speech similarly after a brain injury or stroke. And then I suppose with the private work, the option is there for people to keep coming. And it can get to that maintenance level, where you want to maintain a certain level of functioning. And whether that's mental health, whether that's, you know, mobility or communication, I suppose it's across the board. But generally we'd have, similar to any other therapy, an assessment piece at the start whereby you're really just getting to know each other and how can we help? What can we do here musically or rhythmically or whatever it might be to help you get to where you want to be? I think what I find with a lot of our longer term clients, it goes through stages, and it might start with being very functional, very mechanical almost. Right, we're going to work on your speech, get your language back or improve your language. We're going to work on your walking, improve on that. And I think through that work, that rapport that we were talking about earlier, that relationship has a chance to kind of organically grow.
Yeah.
And then from there, it might be the more mood related, you know, mental health side of things. You know, a lot of the people we work with have gone through massive trauma, whether that be a traumatic brain injury or a traumatic event, or similarly a diagnosis that has just changed their life and turned their lives upside down. So it's working through all of that, but it's also unpacking it and trying to make it a bit more manageable for people.
That's incredible. Yeah, because I'd say there's must be days where, like, you see people working really hard, but your heart may break for them a little bit because, well, a lot probably because of the type of shock their system has been through, or is currently going through. How do you process that? Mm-hmm. Because you are a wonderful person. I love talking to you. I really enjoy it. Like, and I always get to a point with you where I feel like I can share everything with you. You're kind of one of those empaths, like you can kind of take on people's kind of emotion or feelings.
Yeah.
How do you process the emotion?
Mm. Yeah, great question. It's and it is such an important point, and it's probably something we don't talk about enough. So obviously, from a kind of a surface level answer, first of all, we go to supervision. So as therapists, we go to regular supervision. We'd have a supervisor where we go and kind of speak about our caseload, speak about the clinical work, and it's that kind of offloading. But that's fine. That's kind of ethically, you just have to do that as a therapist. That's okay. That's kind of a given. But then I think we have to have in place our own strategies, like on a day to day, you know, so you come home in the evening. And I know for me, it sounds bizarre as a music therapist, but sometimes just silence for me to come home and just have a quiet space for an hour or whatever it might be, you know, just to kind of, like you say, process everything that's gone on that day. You know, you could work with. So today, for example, I had 3 individual clients and I had 2 groups. So when you put all of that together, there's a lot of people, a lot of trauma, a lot of experiences. And while it was all really positive, there's also a lot in that you're kind of taking on. And I think to do what we do, you've got to, like you said, the empathy needs to be there. So you've got to almost meet a person where they're at. So you have to take on some of those feelings that they're experiencing to help them. But like you say, you need to be able to close that off then at the end of the day, because otherwise it's going to lead to burnout. So
yeah, because it's like at the end of the day, you're human, right? So yeah. Like you're not a machine, even though you probably have to present yourself as then infallible or untouchable because you have the qualifications. And I noticed it, like even with doctors and nurses and people in HR as well, for example.
Yeah.
They can take a lot of the burden upon themselves because they are so caring and they want to help. But if you don't have an outlet to like share experiences or share frustrations,
yeah,
it can be very, very difficult. And I'm delighted to hear that you try and create that kind of moment of silence. But have you ever found a time where you couldn't manage it and that you needed an alternative or there was something else that you needed to do? Because it would be interesting to understand the human element of your job as well.
Well, I think for me, there are probably 3 things that I try. Don't always get there with consistency, but try, like meditation for me would be one. Like I try and build that into my morning routine. I was doing really well. It was my New Year's resolution. And for the first 3.5 months, I was doing so well. The last 6 weeks have just been so crazy. And you know what? The horrendous thing about it, that's when you should be really doing it. Like, you know, I was doing it so frequently and consistently up until that. You know, then I just fell off the bandwagon with it. But meditation is a big one for me. And the gym. Just using kind of, again, that's my outlet, I would say, because I can be there on my own. I kind of do my own thing in the gym, headphones in, and it's that kind of, again, it's just, is it quiet time? It is. I suppose it's that quiet time to yourself where you can process things or just go over things or, you know.
Or even not think.
Exactly. Yeah. Park it.
Yeah, just kind of I definitely think it's important that when you're dealing with such seriousness and such kind of trauma that you have that outlet and that you have that freedom. Understanding the benefits of music therapy can be quite challenging, and I think it's great that we're having this conversation because I'm hoping that there'll be more questions. Right, you studied in the University of Limerick, right? Am I correct?
That's right,
so back in my hometown. Go on, UL. But even that
in Ireland to do it.
That university has evolved so much since I graduated from there. When it comes to, so as I said to you before, therapy is a process, right? Mm-hmm. But when it comes to facing challenges, can you speak to us about the biggest challenge you've ever faced?
Okay, good one. There've been many. I suppose the main one that sticks out for me is probably my eyesight. So you've probably noticed, I'm sure you have, my unusual eyes.
Your gorgeous eyes, would you stop?
So I have what's called a colobama, and I have it in both eyes. And basically what it is, it's an eye condition that basically my pupils are dilated all the time. So they're letting in too much light. So a lot of people would say, oh, you know, they'll see me squinting at my phone or squinting at a menu or something. And I go, oh, would you not wear glasses? I'm like, well, no, glasses don't actually work. It's a light thing. It's a light sensitivity. So sunglasses might work, but I'm not going to wander around the clinic or the hospital in my shade.
Like Bono.
Yeah, exactly. So that was definitely, I suppose that it's always been there. Like I was born with it, you know, so I never really, in ways, I coped quite well with it as a child and as a teenager. I think, in fact, it massively trained my ear. So going back to secondary school, and I remember teachers being like, oh, sit up the front, like sit up at the very front. And I, in my head, been like, still won't see it. Like, even if I am at the very front, but I used to just pretend. I'd be like, right, grand. just keep quiet, grand. But I'd be kind of scribing down exactly at what they're saying. So it really, I just had to train my ear to such a level to take what they were saying in and to really hang on to every word. So silver lining, I suppose. But I guess when I got to age 17, when it was looking at driving and went for, had been kind of going to consultations all the way through childhood, all the rest of it, and got to that age and they were like, oh no, you can't drive. You can't drive. So I think hearing that as a 17-year-old, that was tough. You know, we live in Ireland. We were voted the worst public transport in Europe last week. So not exactly the place to not be allowed drive. And yeah, so there was that, I think, was a really tough time. It was the first time, I think, that it really meant something, you know, that that condition ever held me back, or, you know, I felt like that was a massive, and I think I just took it really badly.
How did you react to that?
Just, I think I kind of went into myself for a while. I didn't really process it. I just buried it a little bit, and it was a time I was starting college. There was a lot of other things happening, so it was easy to be busy and you know, just, yeah, I suppose avoid the issue. But eventually I did go, and I actually went to therapy myself and spoke to someone, and that was, yeah, that was my first experience in therapy, and kind of saw that process of, and that was talk therapy, for the first time. So I suppose my interest in it was kind of from there. So it's in a way come full circle. And then a follow up to that was actually only 2 years ago. I won't say my age, but well on from when I was 17, went and I had to do for work, had to do a kind of a, what would you say, just a medical examination. And part of that was assessing my eyes. And I went in and the guy said, oh, okay, so why are you here? And I said, well, look, I have this eye condition, and one of the places I work just need you to verify that I'm okay to work. And he's kind of looking at me puzzled. And so he did all the tests, and it's like, yeah, well, obviously you're fine. Like, you're absolutely grand. And I just happened to say, well, the only way it kind of affects me on a daily basis is that I can't drive. And again, he just looked absolutely dumbfounded. So he did another few tests, and he was like, there's absolutely no reason why you should not be driving.
Really?
But I had just kind of taken it for granted that that was you know, that this is my site since I was born, so I don't know any different. But obviously I was told so many years ago that you can't drive. So then to be told well into your 30s, let's say, that actually you can and you should be driving. That was a bit of a knock, but it didn't. Look, I'm at a stage of life now where I think I've processed that. And I did, like I say, go to therapy initially around that. And I think there was definitely frustration hearing that, but it was easier to cope with.
And when you bottled it all in, right? When you kind of were busy and you kind of used the other things as distractions, not to potentially deal with the bigger issue.
Mm.
How did you rebel? Or like, and what were the tools that you learned to use? Like, what was the mindset shift that helped you get over the fact, not maybe get over the fact, but like manage the fact that for the first time in your life, you had been told you couldn't do something that everybody else takes for granted that they can do?
Yeah. I don't know what the shift was. I suppose just, yeah, coming to terms with it. And there was a move. So obviously at that stage, I was living here in the city centre. So it was a lot easier, obviously, to get around. And, yeah. You know, I was no longer in rural Ireland. So that did help.
Thank God, says you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, but mindset wise, though, I suppose I'm quite a positive person, and I always try to see the best in things, even if it's not great. So I suppose turning to that and just leaning into that a bit, I guess, was my out of that. You know?
Yeah, it's kind of accepting that this is the way it is. So it's like, right, how do I make the best out of this situation?
Yeah.
And applying it in a positive way, as you said. So happy days that you have that you had that kind of wherewithal. And I suppose,
thankfully,
talk, because some people focus on what they don't have instead of focusing on what they do, right?
Yeah.
So, and I think, again, when you can focus on what you do have, it can kind of change a lot of things in your life.
And I think what everything I do goes back to my auditory. So I think I've always been so thankful for my hearing being intact and for that aspect of things being fine.
Interestingly, my father is in the opposite, right? So he went through his whole life with, I think, about 15 or 20% hearing.
Wow.
And they didn't know that he was deaf.
Yeah.
Back in those days, it was only until he was about 22 when he went working in a job that they put up these windows that were soundproof.
Right.
And he felt like he was in a bubble. And that's when he realized that he needed hearing aids.
Wow.
So now he loves music, but he loves the beat of it. He loves the percussion. He loves that. And my sister's a good singer and all that stuff. But it's just interesting to hear the difference in yours is with your sight and his was with his hearing. Anyway. Pointless, but it's just there's some sort of connection there, I think.
Yeah.
If we look at, say, the young Shane growing up, and now, as you say, you're in your prime years. if you were to kind of pass on a piece of advice to young Shane, considering the world that you've kind of lived in, considering the challenges that you've faced, and the opportunities you've realized and battles overcome, what would you say to that young Shane of yours who is about to embark on a whole adventure of life?
Yeah. Sounds a bit cheesy, but something along the lines of just go for it. Just like, I'm a procrastinator and I will toy things and I'll you know, pros and cons, and I'll have this, that, and the other, all lists and everything, but actually just going for it, taking a bit of a gamble, taking a bit of a risk. I think just not letting fears hold you back, I think, would be would be up there, I think, with the advice, certainly. Yeah.
And what's your biggest fear?
My biggest fear now, I don't know. Yeah. I suppose I'm more aware of stepping outside of my comfort zone. I think the older I get, the better I'm becoming at that, maybe.
Yeah.
And I think for some people it might be the opposite, but yeah, I think, you know, kind of giving myself new challenges as I go. And I think I always want to do that. I'd never want to become stuck or doing the same thing. I think I get bored quite easily, maybe. I don't know what it is. But yeah, always just stepping it up a notch and extending that comfort zone. Just
there's the media,
that kind of, even social media. Like, I mean, I'm not one for radio or camera or talking live on anything. So that for me is definitely stepping outside my comfort zone.
Well, like you are a fountain of knowledge, you know, and I think you, and especially in a world that people don't necessarily know at the moment, especially in the world of music therapy, especially, right? Yeah. So the only way that you can tell, get the name out there or get the knowledge out there is by telling that story. It's like a good Shana Key. They're great at telling stories, right? And they may have told this story 1,000 times before, but every time they tell it, it's like the first person, it's like a person is hearing it for the first time.
Exactly.
And it's to continue with that passion.
Yeah.
So I think you're doing a great job. And I think to that point, why don't we tell the world what's going on with Shane Cassidy, with Neuralynx, what's happening, where can they find you? The microphone is yours, so let people know what's happening.
Yeah, well, exciting times. We are, as I said to you earlier, we have our own clinic in Sandyford. We are on the move very shortly, but we'll be in or around the same vicinity. So we're moving to a slightly bigger premises. We do one-to-one and group work, or we will be doing group sessions when we get the new space. And our website is neuralynx.ie. And for anyone with any questions or comments or queries, it's just hello@neuralynx.ie.
Super stuff, Shane. Well, listen, number one, I love the chat. Thank you for coming on and for being so honest and open about not just the world of music therapy, but the world of Shane Cassidy. I do think that there's a lot of things that people can learn. One of the reasons I wanted you on is because I'm so impressed with your approach to life. And I do think that you bring this energy that a lot of people need in their lives. And for me, I'm delighted that you have your space to figure things out and to switch off, but you'll always have a friend on this side of the microphone. That's for sure. So
appreciate
you for coming on and good luck with everything. I'll put everything into the show notes and
amazing. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Shano.
Once again, thank you for joining me on season 4 and taking part in this journey where we talk to people like you and me about what motivates them, what inspires them, and ultimately what makes them tick. I've learned so much from the various conversations I've had, and I hope you can take something from this that you can apply to your life. That's why this podcast has been created. I'm very proud of it, and I'm very thankful for everybody who's joined me so far. Thank you all for listening.